The Athletic.
Hi there, this is the Athletic FC podcast weekend preview, and it is match day 33. I'm Adam Leventhal, and we are here in a slightly strange setup. I'm at home, but the three amigos are in the studio, as you can see. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening in your podcast place, then it will sound no different, and I needn't have mentioned it for you. Alongside me today is Tim Spears. How are you, Tim?
Yeah, fine, mate. Nice of you to turn up.
Yeah. I'm on holiday. Is that all right? Is that okay?
Where have you gone on holiday?
Yeah, I've gone to my house. So I'm here. I'm here, but on holiday. Doesn't matter. I wanted to ask you, this week, obviously we've seen some crazy Champions League games. What did you try and do? You watched two games at once. What were you doing?
Yeah, I was tasked with watching both games at the same time, which was a struggle. My internet went down at one point, so I was sort of channel hopping for the first half an hour, and I missed four goals because I was on the wrong channels. So I had a bit of bad luck. I kept flipping to the channel where there hadn't been a goal. They would show the replay from the other match. That was my way of watching it, basically. But there was a sort of a serious point to it that, you know, two of the biggest games of the entire season are at the same time, which is ridiculous. It doesn't really happen in any other sport, you know, World Championships, World Cups, when you get to sort of quarterfinal, semi-final stage, they're never on at the same time. So I was quite annoyed, really.
For people who weren't in the loop, which games were these that were head-to-head that you were talking about?
Yes, should have pointed that out. This was Arsenal, Bayern Munich and Real Madrid, Man City.
Excellent. You should have just had them on two screens side by side, though, yeah?
No, I did try that, but then the internet failed. But it's not the same, though. You can't watch it properly. I'm sure John tries to do this every weekend.
I never watch more than one game at a time because there's literally no point, in my opinion.
Yeah, you can't get into it tactically or emotionally, which are two of my favourite things to get into. So, you know.
Yes, quite. Art de Roche is in the studio. How are you, Art?
I think I'm better than Tim.
Yeah.
To be fair, I didn't have to channel hop on Tuesday thanks to being at the game. So most of, I guess, post that has been recovery because of the late Champions League kickoff times, which is something I've actually grown to dislike. I want to bring back the 7:45 kickoffs. I think that 15 minutes makes a very big difference. But yeah, I'm all good. All good. Thank you, Adam.
Just to formally introduce John McKenzie, who is also here. What's been the highlight of your week, John?
Talking to you, as it always is, Adam.
Second to that?
It's been a busy week, but the Champions League fixtures have been, I think, interesting. It's like it's the first time really that I've watched all of them in any great detail because we've done a show on all four of them. So it's been good to get all of them watched. And yeah, it's a fun mix up of teams, I think.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Well, let's focus on the Premier League now. And it is a 6-3-1 setup. Saturday, Sunday, we have a Monday night football, which is always good. I think it's what people like to know. Have I got a game on Monday night to watch? And it is a good one. We'll go into that in a bit. Saturday, 12:30. All these times are British summertime. We have Newcastle against Spurs, which we'll be talking about. 4:00-3:00 p.m. on Saturday. Brentford against Sheffield United. Burnley, Brighton. Man City, Luton. And then the Nuno Espirito Santo derby. Nottingham Forest against Wolves. Then rounding off Saturday, we have Bournemouth against the Box of Chocolates that is Manchester United at 5:30. Then on Sunday at 2, Liverpool, Crystal Palace and West Ham against Fulham, followed by the league leaders Arsenal hosting Aston Villa at 4:30. And then the MNF is Chelsea against Everton at 8 o'clock. But let's start in North London. And it is Arsenal hosting Aston Villa. It's not been this tight at the top of the table for quite some time. Arsenal with 71 points plus 51 goal difference. Then Liverpool also on 71 points with plus 42 goal difference. So quite a big advantage. 9 goals for Arsenal. Then Manchester City on 70 points plus 40. Quick whistle around the three of you. Starting with you, Art. Which team is best positioned when you look at the run-ins to win the title?
I'd say if you look at it from a games perspective, you'd probably say Manchester City. But I would say from an Arsenal perspective, I think they're in a better position than they were last year when they were, say, 8 points ahead, because they don't have the risk of getting complacent. They do actually have to stay focused for as long as possible. So I'd say it's between those two. If you're looking at it just from a games perspective, probably Manchester City though.
Tim?
City have got easiest run in, best manager, top scorer in the league, probably the form player in the league in Foden at the moment. And obviously, you know, they know how to do it. They know how to win it. So I'd put them slight favourites on that front. But Liverpool have got this weird emotional thing with Klopp and winning late matches. And I tell you what, the curveball for me would be if Arsenal and City both progress in the Champions League next week, then they will, of course, play each other right at the business end, the pivotal moment of the season, I think like 2-3 games from the end. And again, it's back to back. It's like it's a Tuesday to the next Wednesday kind of thing. That's got to have a bearing on the title if they end up playing each other, which I guess we all hope they do.
It would add an extra sort of frisson of confusion, excitement, and just carnage to the title race if they were going head-to-head as well in the Champions League. John, looking at the run-ins, who's got it for you?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously Arsenal are the form team. They've come into the new year and barely put a foot wrong. But in the Champions League, they've looked very fragile indeed. So, and I think part of that is to do with the fact that teams are now finding ways of causing them problems. So for me, the big question is, I would say on paper, I'd expect Arsenal to come through and win the league. But the big question for me is, do we start seeing teams in the Premier League doing similar things that we've seen teams in the Champions League do and to cause them some problems? So, yeah, I think it's really nicely set up. And as Tim says, just adding in the possibility of a semi-final double header against Arsenal and City just makes the whole affair quite an interesting prospect.
Let's focus on the game against Villa. Obviously, the game against Bayern Munich is coming up after this one, the second leg. How much will it influence selection, do you think, for Mikel Arteta, or can it not? These are just two big games and you just go again.
I think because of the way the first leg against Bayern Munich went, it kind of does have to influence things, even if it is a little bit. In my mind, that would look like almost a preparation for the second leg against Bayern Munich. So I'd expect some changes, but not a lot. One of the big kind of talking points around Arsenal going into this block of games was how they use their squad. And Arteta made 5 changes for the Luton game, the first midweek game of this month. I wouldn't expect the same amount of changes for Villa, maybe 2 or 3, but a 2 or 3 that are very kind of telling for how he would want to, I guess, warm these players up for buying away. So when I'm looking at that squad, I'm thinking of that left-hand side with probably Tomiyasu getting some minutes because he hasn't started in ages. And also, do you give Gabriel Martinelli another start? Because even though he did start against Bayern, that was his first start for a while too. And you could really tell that, I felt. I'd say maybe 2 or 3 changes from midweek for Aston Villa.
When you look at the form for Arsenal, Tim, 10 wins out of 11 since they had their winter wobble, went away and then came back and they were gods again. They've kept their nerve of late. Last week, the order of the games, of the title challenges, was City first, then Arsenal, then Liverpool, who played against Manchester United and had a little bit of a blip. This week, it's City, Liverpool, and then Arsenal. We've obviously talked about the run-ins. Does the order have a psychological effect, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does. I think managers and players would tell you that. You know, you want to be going first, really. No emotional baggage from the weekend. Just get in and do the job. I saw Eric Dier was asked about this or spoke about this week in an interview, how Leverkusen have had a bit of a habit of going first. And recently they played Hoffenheim first and were 1-0 down until like the 88th minute, Leverkusen, and then they won it 2-1 with 2 very late goals. And an hour later, Bayern, having watched that, then played Dortmund at home. And, you know, Dier said that it was on our minds. You know, it's very demoralising to see that an hour before you go into a massive game against Dortmund at home, which they duly lost. So yeah, I think it undoubtedly has an impact. You don't want to be going last if possible.
John, from your point of view, do you think that clubs who are playing teams that are in the Champions League after they have played get more valuable pointers as to holes in their armoury because they've come up against Champions League teams, obviously now in the latter stages of the competition. So they're up against higher calibre coaches. So it's almost a disadvantage coming back into league action when you've maybe had a bigger, a better team trying to sort of figure you out.
Yeah, I mean, I touched on it already that we are starting to see managers in the Champions League come up with solutions to some of the problems that Arsenal pose teams in the Premier League. And I guess for me, there's a couple of things. One of them is, to what extent are a team going to be willing to make changes tactically? And this is the big question, right? If let's say, for example, Arsenal still have to play Spurs. Spurs are very unlikely, I would suggest, to play a different way because of their coach, who is very idealistic and is on record saying this is the way we play. Could Spurs cause a problem if they maybe were happier to be antagonists rather than protagonists? Probably, but I think it's unlikely that will happen. Whereas I think in a knockout tournament, what we've seen from Porto and what we've seen from Thomas Tuchel, who are both the team and the coach, happy to be a little bit more reactive than active in terms of how they're going to approach things, it does change the context a little bit. So if the big question for me is that going through the list of teams that Arsenal are playing is like, which managers do we think have the combination of the level of players that you need to be able to cause Arsenal problems with a manager who's going to be willing to say, okay, this week we're going to change things up and try and make things difficult for them. And to be honest, I think this is the most difficult game that Arsenal have in that respect, because I think Unai Emery is a reactive coach. And he is the sort of coach who will come into this with a plan, which is probably defence first. And he has the calibre of players who can hurt Arsenal if they get it right. We know that because they've already won a game against Arsenal this season. So I think this is probably the most difficult weekend for Arteta in that respect.
That said, Villa aren't in great form though, are they? One win out of five. They're now fifth behind Spurs on goal difference, albeit it doesn't really matter because they're going to finish in the top five because they're 11 clear of Manchester United in sixth. Fifth doesn't guarantee you Champions League football as yet. They're 12th in the form table over the last five games. Tim, why have they slipped, relatively speaking? They're still doing really well, but what has been the drop-off, do you think, for them?
The season's probably just caught up with them a little bit. They were overachieving and overperforming, you know, what with winning 14 games in a row at home. And you know they haven't got the squad to compete with the top three, and so, yeah, they've just dipped down a bit and leveled out, I guess, but still having a fantastic season. Completely agree with John actually that this is it's ripe for a bit of an upset. You've got the Emery factor as well. It's his first return to the Emirates for a game with fans, I think, since he was sacked. He came back in the COVID season and took Villarreal to the Europa League final in the semis. Did a bit of a number on them then, and you know he's going to come up with a decent tactical plan, and Ollie Watkins is back. And I think, yeah, sandwiched in between these Bayern Munich games is far from ideal. You know, you want Luton at home, which is what Man City have got, which is what Arsenal had a couple of weeks ago when they could rest players. So that definitely plays a part of it. Yeah, I'd be slightly concerned for Arsenal for this one.
Word on Douglas Luiz's art, because he's suspended, so that's another blow for Aston Villa. Someone who's repeatedly been linked with Arsenal. And it was interesting, he was asked about it this week and sort of did the normal sort of footballer committed to the cause, bloody, bloody, blah, blah, etc. Loving it here, da-da-da-da-da. Would he fit in at Arsenal, or do you think that ship has sailed in terms of him potentially being an option for them?
Yeah, I think the most important thing, I guess, around Douglas Luiz now conversation is the age profile. Because I feel like when Mikel Arteta and Edu identify a player, they do it based off their attributes. So they're not just doing it because they think a player is talented, but because they feel they are the right fit. And I think when you look at Arsenal's midfield and the way it's set up, he's someone who could fit kind of a few different molds in there. So he could sit if needed, like Jorginho and Partey do. But he could also actually do the job that Declan Rice does in a more advanced position where A, he's a bit more aggressive off the ball, but B, he's also very good on the ball. So I wouldn't see it as a ship sailing in terms of the type of player. It would just depend on, do they feel he's probably past the age they want to look for, especially if they're already trying to kind of think ahead in terms of a long-term plan for how that midfield kind of looks going forward.
If we can't sell him to Arsenal, I just wanted to talk about trying to sell someone else that Aston Villa have, rather than talking about his England credentials with you, John, because I know you hate that. You know, he's returned to the side, scored twice in the draw against Brentford. This is Ollie Watkins we're talking about. He's got a long contract until 2028, 18 goals, 10 assists. When does he become an option that bigger fish start looking at, do you think?
I think that they'll be looking at him already, surely. The nine market is always fairly thin, because we're talking about players who can make a difference at the most important aspect of the game, which is putting the ball in the net. And 18 goals and 10 assists is an insane return from a player like Ollie Watkins. So yeah, he'll absolutely be at the forefront of a lot of these big teams' minds. He's also, we've talked about this before, a very flexible player. He came through playing as a wide forward. So, you know, the big teams like to have those sorts of profiles of players where you can play him as a out and out nine if you want, but you can also use him as a second striker. You can use him as a wide forward as well. So it's basically just the perfect, and he's good age for it as well. So I think all of these things come together, and you know, he's going to be very valuable. He's on a long contract, so Villa will be happy that they'll probably, if anyone does come in for him, they'll get a big fee.
Let's get quick score predictions, starting with you, Art.
Ooh. I'd say a 3-1 Arsenal. I feel like the discussion around kind of the timing of the games was quite interesting earlier, but also Arsenal have kind of flipped it recently as well, where before the international break, they played, I think, after Liverpool and Manchester City 2 weeks in a row, and they beat Newcastle 4-1 and then Sheffield United 6-0. I know this will be a very different game, but I also think the fact that Unai Emery will be a kind of defend first approach, take that approach to this game, I think it could help them, because it will almost be like a dress rehearsal for that Bayern game, because their players have very similar threats in regards to their wide players. So if he wants to use it in that sort of way, I think he could try and start fast and then take the game from there. So yeah. That's why I've gone for that prediction.
Okay. Tim?
I mean, Art makes some great points, to be fair. 2-1 Villa.
Excellent. And John?
I'll go 2-1 Arsenal.
Lovely. Thank you. That's Villa in the Premier League. They're obviously still spinning their Europa Conference League plate as well. Let's just check in with how their quarterfinal first leg against Lille went with Jacob Tanswell.
So it ends here, Aston Villa 2, Lille 1, and it's a result and a performance that Unai Emery would take, although there are probably a few more doubts heading into the second leg in 7 days' time. It was a difficult game for Aston Villa. I think they expected to control possession a lot more, but in the end, they struggled with Lille's high ball dominance. I think it was 60% they had overall throughout the game, and Lille played really well. They were very composed from the outset. Aston Villa tried to press, but they play out through the back, and they controlled a lot of the game and restricted Villa, really, and they had a lot of chances of their own. Emiliano Martinez in the first half was phenomenal. Aston Villa could have conceded two or three in that first half had it not been for Martinez spoiling himself in 1v1. Situations. He was the outstanding player, and again, it was a theme of Villa's first half, really, relying on their two irreplaceable players in one end, Emilio Martinez, and at the other, Ollie Watkins, his 25th goal of the season, and it was a clever set play routine that opened the scoring. And as it proved, Villa's evening was really defined by set plays. Obviously, the second goal as well came from a short corner, played out to John McGinn, who then scored from the edge of the box, and then the unfortunate and probably the rueful area for Aston Villa is the goal they conceded, you know, 6-7 minutes before time, when they failed to win the first contact and it was nudged in by Diakite at the front post to half the deficit, and that's how it ended. It's a game where Villa will rue that, because McGinn scored on the hour mark, 2-0 up, Villa Park was bouncing, and you thought if they can get a third, potentially they could kill the game off, kill the tie off, and they'll have to go to Lille next week with a little bit less pressure on them. Where now Lille are back in it, they had a lot more of the chances, possession, and they'll probably fancy themselves to really put Aston Villa under the pump next week. It obviously helps as well that they haven't got a game until then. Lille, they've got 7 days where they can prepare solely for the second leg, whereas Villa have to go to the Emirates, probably the biggest test in the moment in the Premier League on Sunday.
So that's Villa. If you want more on Arsenal, do check out the show with Io, with Art, who was in the studio once again, and Jordan Campbell, another one of our Arsenal writers, and the podcast that they did on Mikel Arteta on this feed a little bit earlier on in the week. And whilst you're at it, you can check out our dedicated Arsenal podcast, which is Handbrake Off.
Hello, everyone. It's Ian Stone, host of Handbrake Off, the Arsenal podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Well, we're in the home straight of the season, so to keep up with all the goings-on during the run-in, join me, Amy Lawrence, James McNicholas, Adrian Clarke and Art DeRoche twice a week as we chart what we all hope will be a memorable end to the campaign. Listen for free wherever you usually get your podcasts.
Okay, next up, we have Newcastle against Tottenham at St James's Park. You'll remember the game last season. Newcastle were 5-0 up after 21 minutes and it finished 6-1. Then you switch to this season, very different story. Spurs won the reverse 4-1. And I suppose, sort of symbolic of two sides heading in different directions overall this season. Having said that, Newcastle have got better, and they've needed to. Only two defeats in their last 10 after they'd lost 6 out of 7. A win could get them back up to 6th place in the league, Newcastle, which, all things considered, Tim, would be a good season for Eddie Howe and co, would it not?
Absolutely. They were sort of heading down to the bottom half of the table, you know, recently. They've got a nice run in. Sheffield United, Burnley, Brentford and Palace in their final 6 after this one. And they've also got Brighton and Man United. So, you know, Europe is there if they can sort of find the consistency that's eluded them, you know, pretty much all season. I mean, it's a drop-off, obviously, from last season either way. They got 71 points last season and they can only get to 68 if they win their final 7, which they're not going to. So they're going to be some way off what they were last year. But I think with the injuries they've had and partly the Champions League exertions, you know, before Christmas, are sort of reasons behind that, and 6 would be an excellent finish. You know, we were asking the question a lot about Eddie Howe a few weeks ago, but it doesn't feel like his position is vulnerable at all. I think you'd have to make a pretty bad start for next season for that to be in question, but he looks pretty safe for the summer for me, you know, and rightly so.
John, if you add Anthony Gordon and Harvey Barnes to Tottenham's high line, what's the answer?
It's interesting you mentioned the high line, because I think, like most teams in the Premier League, play a high line. I think for me, what's so vulnerable about Spurs is they play with just the two centre-backs doing a lot of covering, which leaves them quite open. When those centre-backs are Mickey van der Ven, who is, what's the phrase I use, a cheat code as a defender.
Yeah, can you stop?
He's just so good at covering that kind of open space in those transitional moments. Christian Romero, very good at it as well. And it's obviously a big part of their game plan, right? It's the fewer players that you defend with, the more players you attack with. I think that's part of the reason why we've seen Spurs in so many high scoring games this season. So yeah, Anthony Gordon and Harvey Barnes, Miguel Almiron, although he may be injured. Those sorts of players, those sorts of profiles, are going to be the players that you're going to try and get activated in those sort of transitional moments. I think that Spurs, they accept that, you know, we've already mentioned in this episode that Postecoglou will be happy saying, yeah, you know, we bake those sorts of moments into our game plan. And the idea is that, yes, we give up big chances, but the theory is we should be able to generate big chances of our own, and we should have the confidence that our players will come out on top in the matchup between that and the opposition. There's been a fairly interesting clip of Erik ten Hag going around the internet talking to Ruud Gullit back when he was at Ajax on Dutch TV, talking about very similar things, where Ruud Gullit was saying, if you defend in this way, you're going to concede goals. And he's saying, yes, we know, but that's all baked into our approach. Now, we can have arguments about whether or not that's the best approach and whether or not it's wise playing in that way, especially in the Premier League, I think, where you do get punished for these things. But yeah, I think it'll be business as usual for Spurs. They'll say, we reckon in the battle between Christian Romero and Anthony Gordon and Harvey Barnes and Mickey van der Ven that will more often than not come out on top, and we're happy to take that gamble.
So, Tim, considering what John has said there, I wanted to put this to you, and we've spoken about Ange's style of play throughout and the fact that he's very comfortable in his own skin and he likes that risk-reward football, etc., etc. One clean sheet in 14 games, but then you balance that out with over the last 15 games, they're fourth in the form table. So do you still embrace that style, or do you think it has the potential to actually cost them a higher finish this season? Or, in brackets, it doesn't really matter because Manchester United is so far behind, so they're guaranteed to finish in the top five anyway.
Well, he says it doesn't matter anyway. If you listen to what he says in his press conferences and take his word for it, he's like, it doesn't matter where we finish, it doesn't matter if we're in the Champions League or not. It's about, and I like it. I like his sort of, it's a refreshing attitude. It's like, we're evolving. This is about what we're building towards. But you can't build towards trophies, certainly a league trophy, with the defence that they've got. I mean, their XG against this season is 51, which is the 12th best in the league. You know, they're sort of worse than Brentford, Forest and Bournemouth in terms of the chances they concede. For context, Arsenal's is 21, you know, compared to 51. So that's the gap they've got to bridge if they're going to have a defence that's good enough to win the title, which is obviously what they're building towards, not next season or maybe not the season after. But, you know, Vicario's got them out of trouble a lot this season. He's overperformed. Van der Ven gets them out of trouble time and again. He gets Romero out of trouble. He gets the fullbacks out of trouble with his pace. It's too high risk for where they want to go eventually. He'll have to evolve and change it. But with the players he's got, with one summer transfer window, the football they play, I think he's done a fabulous job.
Yeah, just on that, I think it's really interesting kind of viewing it from an Arsenal perspective, kind of 3 years in advance, because I remember having kind of similar conversations when, say, Ben White first came into the club. Mikel Arteta was like, very much, you're going to defend on the halfway line. And he could do that, but he was exposed a lot in his first season with Gabriel at centre back as well. And I think, as you say, a couple of windows will help with that. The fact that is such an extreme kind of switch from, say, what Conte was doing as well is also a factor in that. I take that opinion on trajectory rather than immediate results, because Arsenal missed out on the Champions League to Tottenham a couple of seasons ago. Then they missed out on the Premier League last year. But I think everybody recognises this year that whether they win the league or not, they're still on the upward trajectory. So I really do kind of take Ange's point to be more kind of thinking more long term rather than just about what the current result is, because a lot of the stuff that he is kind of trying to implement isn't just about this season, it's about the next few years.
Everyone will say trust the process, but people are very bad at determining what the process looks like when you're in the middle of it. And like you say, with Arteta, the process was bring in profiles that are going to fit the style of play. And you know, it's the idea that you don't play the ambitious elite style of football until you have the players to do it, or do you start playing that style of play early and have those teething problems, and then when you bring in the better players, the other players around them are already ready to play that system, and you get the growth there. So yeah, I'm absolutely on board with both of these guys. Let Ange do his thing, give him the players that he needs, and eventually, you know, they will hope to be in that group of teams now that we're talking about in the title race, where they're consistently at the top of the table challenging for the title.
Tottenham have the potential to be kingmakers in this title race. They face Liverpool, Arsenal and City in the final seven games that they have. North London Derby is next after this game against Newcastle. What do you think's more likely, considering what we've said about style of play, personnel, etc., etc., that they take 9 points off those three title challengers, or they lose all three and then that has more of an impact on them finishing in fourth?
It's a really good question, because they're unbeaten against the title contenders this season. Beat nine-man Liverpool at home. They drew 3-3 at Man City and they drew 2-2 at Arsenal, which was a really very impressive performance. They massively came under the cosh for half an hour and then played their way out of it. It was really impressive to watch. They're probably more likely to lose all three, just given the form of the other title contenders. I think, is it only Liverpool who've dropped points this calendar year against the team that isn't one of the title contenders? So that suggests that they can all beat Spurs. But I tell you what, all three of those games are going to be incredibly watchable.
Let's move on to the all-important score predictions. Let's start with you, Art. Newcastle Spurs.
I will say 2-2. I just think both a bit inconsistent. I think there will be goals, but I just can't pick a winner. So that's why I've gone with 2-2.
There are always goals in these games. 65 goals scored and 52 conceded. Newcastle's Premier League games have had more goals in them than any other side this season with 117. Spurs are ranked joint fourth. 65 scored, 45 conceded. So there will always be goals. And John is going to predict...
These two teams are the most 4-3 teams in the world, right? So it's going to be 4-3 to one of the teams. I'll go with Spurs. Spurs will win this 4-3.
4-3. It's all the rage, isn't it, Tim? What's the score going to be?
4-3 to Newcastle.
Excellent. It'd be great if it was. Right, let's crack on with some of the other games this weekend. Should be a really interesting Monday night football. Chelsea against Everton. Chelsea ninth. They could still get European football. Is that success for Pochettino if that happens, Tim?
I don't know. No, obviously, because they're one of the most expensive squads that's ever been built.
I sort of have a little bit of sympathy for Chelsea, because if you look at the profile of their squad, I think a lot of other teams would look at it and go, wow, I would love to have some of those players in my squad. Maybe not all of them in the squad all at the same time playing, but they have got a lot of players that a lot of other teams would like. So that said, they are sort of moving in slightly the right direction if they finish in Europe?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't think he's doing a very good job, to be honest. I mean, they've conceded at least two goals in the last seven games. And that run has included matches against Championship opposition in Leicester and Leeds and Championship bound opposition in Burnley, Sheffield United. So they can't, but it's not a Man United thing where it's sort of almost part of the plan, or you just accept it. It's just rubbish coaching, to be honest. You know, I know they've got their injury worries, but he can't set them up to not concede goals. I know what you mean about Pochettino, but I don't think he's done enough to prove he can take them up a massive level next season and challenge for the top four.
Does anyone want to put the case forward for Poch doing a good job? No?
Not me.
No?
Oh, yeah, so, I think that's okay. A bit above me.
Okay, no, that's good. That's fine. I like that. That's sort of unanimous. Are we unanimous in the fact that, aside from the fact that it may well end up 8-7, that we all like to watch Chelsea games because we all like to see what Cole Palmer's going to do next? Art, you're nodding furiously. Is he the most exciting England player that we have? And that is, hold on, aside from Jude Bellingham.
Oh, that was not the name I was expecting to hear.
Oh, okay. Who did you think I was going to say?
There's a guy called Bukayo Saka.
Okay, so you're putting Saka above, I could have said Saka.
And there's a guy called Phil Foden.
I could have said Bellingham, but I didn't.
Those three are probably above Cole Palmer, but I'm not saying that to disrespect Cole Palmer. I really, really like him. And I remember watching, so I was at the Community Shield where he came on for Manchester City and bent it into the far corner. And I was just like, I know it was against Arsenal, but I was wowed by it. And I feel he's like almost a message to academy players throughout the Premier League in terms of what can happen if you don't just accept your squad role at a club. I know he said he wanted to stay at Manchester City and was initially looking to maybe get a loan and then come back. But the way he's been able to kind of thrive as the main man somewhere at a team which is, let's face it, they're mid-table at the minute, but he's been able to put them on his back repeatedly. I know people talk about him scoring a lot of penalties, but he's still got to score them. People don't criticize Harry Kane for scoring penalties. I think he's just shown everyone in England the potential, I guess, of these young guys believing in themselves. And yeah, he's a joy to watch both because of the goals, but also I just think the type of player he is. When you watch Chelsea, one of my biggest frustrations is there's not a lot of players with technical ability who can move with the ball. He's one of them, and he's just a joy to watch. So yeah, hopefully Cole Palmer continues to impress, and I'd like to see him maybe with those guys that we were talking about earlier at the Euros. So yeah, big Cole Palmer fan.
Yeah, I should have probably said up and coming rather than you know, the one that is going to be the main star. You're right. Right, let's switch to the Everton side of this matchup. They're now only 2 points above the drop after that further 2-point deduction. They could still be in 16th because Luton, as we mentioned earlier on, they're up against Manchester City. Forest are hosting Wolves. They may get points, they may not. I wanted to ask you this, John. And I know it's been difficult for Everton, but are they in more trouble than they need to be because of Sean Dyche and his style of football? Or are they only out of the relegation zone because Sean Dyche has done a brilliant job? Where do you sit on it?
Well, I mean, if you look at it purely from the position of Sean Dyche, he'll be thinking, what, 8 points that he's had taken off him for nothing to do with himself. So you add those 8 points and he's comfortably mid-table. So I think Sean Dyche will answer that question. Yeah, that's absolutely because of me that we're in the position that we're in. And had they taken the 8-point deduction last season, they would have gone down. So I definitely think that you can make the argument that Sean Dyche has got them punching above their relative weight. I think there's a lot of Everton fans who would argue that there are endemic problems with this Everton team under Sean Dyche. And, you know, those things are worth talking about. But you've got to remember the position that Everton were in when they brought Dyche in. They wanted someone who was going to keep them up in the league. And it looks as though he is going to do that. Is he going to be the coach who carries them into the top half of the table and makes them a, you know, an outside contender for Europe? Maybe not. But right now, they don't need that coach. They need a coach who is going to be able to deal with these points deductions, deal with the fact that over the next few windows, they're not going to be able to spend much at all because of FFP. And yeah, I think he's exactly the sort of manager that they need in terms of being able to galvanize a club that are basically having to operate, I mean, below their means almost. So yeah, I think that you can look at this both ways. Everton aren't where they are without Sean Dyche. Could they be better? Yeah, in the future, sure. But that's not where they are. They are where they are right now. And so I think Sean Dyche is probably the best scenario for them.
That's all we've got time for. It's been a pleasure to be alongside you, albeit remotely, gentlemen. Thank you to Art for being in the studio.
Thanks for having me again.
John, thanks to you.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be looking out this weekend to find England's next stars so, so I can report back next week.
Thank you very much. And Tim, I look forward to being in your company, sat in that chair that is vacant very, very soon.
Same.
Excellent. Thank you all for listening. Thanks very much for watching on YouTube as well. Thanks very much for listening. Take care. Have a good weekend.
The Athletic.